Okay, welcome everyone to the second panel of the day, which is titled Corporate University, Acknowledging Student, Faculty, and Administration Lines. I'm very honored and privileged to be the moderator today, and thanks to BUCH for organizing this opportunity for us to dialogue. So we'll shortly be hearing from panelists about this topic, and as a way of introduction, very briefly, I'd like to make a couple of points. First, the term corporate university, which has so many potential meanings and evokes so many different responses, both intellectual and emotional. As people do these days, I Google the term out of curiosity. And interestingly, I found a definition of corporate university and examples which I had not been thinking about at all. The examples being places like McDonald's Hamburger University and Disney University and so forth. So the definition was of an educational entity that is a strategic tool designed to help its parent organization in achieving its goals. Obviously, it's not a definition that exactly fits institutions like Boston University, but I think as we left off the discussion from the first panel, it does raise questions that are worth thinking about conceptually and as a somewhat provocative point of comparison. Are we an educational entity that is a strategic tool? And what is the, quote, parent organization here? So my second point, reading the papers prepared by the panelists beforehand, I was struck by the importance of standpoint, and intersectionally, standpoint from multiple perspectives. The view looks pretty different here, depending on where you are standing, whether it's the top floor of Silver Way or the basement of 100 Cummington Mall. And further complicating that, are not just where we are standing or what positions of power or non-power we hold, but also who we are, how we fit into this larger society. So as someone who has spent most of their life and career as a faculty member and only recently entered into the dean's office, I am quite keenly aware personally of the dissonance that exists between different parts of the university. When I decided to accept the associate dean position in CAS, the standing joke among my close faculty friends was that I had gone over to the dark side. And I still routinely get asked, how is it on the dark side? is there any light? And what about those humorless bureaucrats? Who can't take a joke and who are sort of absorbed in business goals, corporate goals. So, of course now, I'm sort of exaggerating, but I think now as someone who's in this kind of interstitial space or position, I've really come to appreciate the value of having, different perspectives, looking at the university from different ways. So without further ado, I'm going to turn to the panelists, and I'll introduce each of them very briefly, then we will go into the, let them speak and have questions after all of them have provided their remarks. And we have very strictly told everyone to not speak for more than 5 minutes, which of course we know for academics is a huge challenge, but we want to make sure that there's enough time for discussion. So on my left is Kimber Chuning, a PhD candidate in the Department of History of Art and Architecture. And then we have Jean Morrison, University Provost and Chief Academic Officer. And after that, we have Peter Schwartz, Associate Professor, Department of World Languages and Literatures. And we have Katie Steinberg, Administrator, Department of History. And we have Jonathan Zetlin, Associate Professor, Department of History. So I think we can just go in the order here. So I'd like to ask Kimber to start.
Okay. Before I begin, I just want to thank all of the organizers for working so tirelessly on this event. So thank you all. This past summer, I was chosen to teach a course on the history of art since 1980. I felt lucky. It was a rare opportunity for which I had to apply, providing evidence, a CV, letters of recommendation, that I was qualified. Before teaching comes preparation, a syllabus, course lectures, assignments. Other more abstract questions of pedagogy also arise. What do I want my students to get out of this class besides an introduction to artists unknown to them? How do I encourage them to be participants in their own learning? How do I balance making the material accessible against the goal of challenging their assumptions and expectations? All of this thinking and planning became moot when I learned that my class had been canceled for the summer due to low enrollment. My concerns quickly shifted to the more immediate question of survival. As a graduate student on a 9-month stipend, there are 4 months out of the year when we have no income. As a student from a working class family, I have no safety net, no financial support from family or a spouse to supplement what income the university determines my work is worth. I am not disparaging anyone who does. However, I am saying that the university can be inhospitable to those that do not. Still, however, I am lucky. My department is very supportive and helped me to manage by providing a patchwork of opportunities. This good fortune has persisted throughout my educational and now professional career. Despite my lack of resources, I have repeatedly found multiple low-wage jobs to support my intellectual curiosity, my passion for art history. A passion for a discipline that can be at times contradictory, but one I find generatively so. Art history taught me how to see. It taught me to be attentive to particularity and the big picture. And as John Berger once said, far from dragging politics into art, art has dragged me into politics. My own background and financial struggles often feel at odds with my devotion to a field, the history of art, that is beholden to wealth. Artistic production has, throughout history, been dependent on wealthy benefactors and patrons whose fortune and tastes have been both embraced and rejected. Still true today, these dynamics were recently in evidence at the Whitney Museum of American Art. Warren B. Kanders, as vice chair of the museum, used some of his $700 million fortune to support exhibitions like its recent blockbuster on Andy Warhol. His fortune comes from his business Safariland, a company that produces tear gas that we know that has been used in Palestine, in South Dakota against water protectors, in Ferguson against protesters, and at the US-Mexico border. Controversy over Kanders' involvement with the Whitney has restaged the question of wealth's overpowering role in the arts. In the art world, it can appear as though radical commitments are only there for display, emptied of their ability to act upon the world at large. While the museum originally stood by Kanders, behaving as if his tainted money could somehow be cleansed by being gifted to a museum, collective pressure, which included the museum staff, ultimately forced Kanders out. While the art world is far from cleansed of malevolent money, it serves as a reminder that collective action works, and that institutions must hear the voices of the workers that sustain them. Like museums, universities are cultural institutions that operate with the language of diversity and inclusion. Both make claims towards societal growth, to deepening understanding of ourselves and each other. Yet I would argue their corporate structuring limits the chance that these initiatives will have any concrete impact. Discourses of hypocrisy arise often in academic discussions. We pride ourselves on providing innovative solutions to precarity and being critically engaged with efforts to improve our communication and relationships. Yet the university is also a place that exploits vulnerability, fostering relationships founded upon competition rather than collective social and civic good. Acknowledging the fault lines between faculty, students, and administration seems like the first step to what, in my eyes, could lead to actual change in the academy. Solidarity. The term corporate university has a distinct weight to it, a towering and distancing pressure that suggests forces beyond human control, forces that must be accommodated rather than challenged. But I would argue that there are ways for us to counteract the sense of being overpowered by a system that is unjust. We often rationalize our potential actions as solitary. If we are good to our particular students or produce critical scholarship, we act to counter that sense of helplessness. However, this is not enough. Like my feelings of luck, these actions by themselves reinforce the ways in which the academy isolates us and keeps the power we wield small. For if change is to happen, it will not be because of the university system or anything innovative that it produces. It will be because of the people and their labor that comprise it. Not only acknowledging that our distinct positions within the university system are intertwined, but that recognition of camaraderie is not satisfactory. That thinking through structural imbalances and imagining a better future depends on a form of reciprocity between all of us to generate material actions. Thank you.
Thank you. So the corporate university, this phrase, of course, brings with it all sorts of implied meaning, much of it viewed as pejorative within the academy. We've all heard arguments in a multitude of settings, from things we read, Chronicle of Higher Education, to our own faculty meetings, that universities are becoming more like corporations. And so the question is, what exactly is meant by this characterization? And I think there are at least two ways that this phrase can be understood in the context of Boston University. First, it could be taken to mean that everyone in the university community is becoming more engaged in the business of the university, and that the business of the university is becoming predominant. Or it could be taken to mean that the business of running the university is eclipsing the longstanding role of faculty governance. And so I'd like to explore these two framings. First, if having a more corporate university means that a larger number of people within the university community are more involved in conversations about the business of how the university is run, how the university budgets work, then yes, I think in that sense, universities are becoming more corporate. And I believe, in fact, that is appropriate and, in fact, necessary. Not a day goes by now that we don't open the newspaper and learn about another college or university that is in serious financial trouble. BU, of course, experienced this firsthand during our recent merger with Wheelock College. We were fortunate and delighted to be able to develop a solution that benefited both Boston University and our new Wheelock College colleagues and students. But in many cases, institutions that face financial trouble simply go out of business. This is really hard to watch, especially in an industry that has seen reliable revenue growth and tuition increases for many decades. But the reality, however, is that the long-standing budget models of many colleges and universities are showing signs of failure. Gone are the days when institutions could anticipate continued growth in all of the important metrics, the number of students who apply, growth in tuition, growth in federal governmental support for the research mission of the institution. Further, decreasing birth rates are leading to decreasing numbers of domestic high school students, and families are increasingly reliant on financial aid to afford college. As tuition rates continue to rise and we read daily headlines about admission scandals at top-tier institutions, the public's also increasingly skeptical of higher education, questioning the value of a degree and the fairness of the industry as a whole. While major research universities like BU are less susceptible to those negative trends that we're seeing in our smaller counterparts, we're by no means immune. Higher education is in a new, disrupted, and challenging landscape. institutional survival going forward, I think will require all of us to pay closer attention to how sound our business model is. And of course, that sounds like a statement from a corporate university. So yes, we are increasingly thinking about ways and considering ways to ensure that we have the funds necessary to support our mission. But we have to be aware that our decisions have financial consequences and keep those in mind as we look to the future. We have a responsibility to our current, our former, and future students to ensure that Boston University will continue to thrive for decades to come. We have a long and proud tradition at BU of actively engaging faculty through committee task forces and the ongoing established faculty governance structures at the university. So I do think that when we turn to the sort of second way of thinking about the definition of a corporate university, are our universities becoming more corporate, and is faculty governance at risk? I actually would disagree with that notion. Shared faculty governance is a core tenet of the university. My office and others across campus spend a great deal of time and effort establishing, populating, and supporting a myriad of faculty committees that guide our work on everything from the establishment of new academic programs to oversight of faculty grievances, to the development of the new university strategic plan. In virtually everything we do, we look to faculty-based committees and task forces for their guidance on these matters. So to end, in short, I think our strength as an institution depends on both the excellence and the investment and the active engagement of our faculty in the university's success. But that has to be combined with an effective strategy and approach to ensuring that we have the resources we need to support the mission of our faculty and the educational mission of our students. Thank you.
Given the time constraints, I'd like to center on one single question. Why do faculty so often seem to feel that they're not being listened to by the central administration, despite the fact that the administration is taking obvious measures to collect feedback from faculty? Why, for example, the ongoing anger at the Hub, despite the fact that the program as planned was a product of months of committee work by faculty drawn from all parts of the university and working in tandem with administrators, many of whom are themselves professors? Why the palpable feeling at every Wednesday CAS faculty meeting I've attended that certain objects of faculty complaint were the products of short-sightedness or high-handedness or some sort of power play on the part of the administration, and the fatalistic suspicion that things won't ever be rectified despite such complaint, notwithstanding the fact that conveying complaint is part of these meetings' purpose? Why the annoyance at the multiplication of task forces and committees, indeed their sometimes dismissal by faculty as gestures meant to legitimate administrative decisions, when these task forces and committees are meant as a way of conveying faculty insight to administrative decision makers? In other words, why such insistent, reflexive, corrosive suspicions of bad faith? For the sake of clarity, let me specify that I'm less interested in understanding these sentiments as objectively justified or not than in trying to understand them as symptoms of a structural problem. For the sake of perspective, I'd like to back up to my first year as faculty here, 2002. I recall my first all-faculty meeting at which John Silber used an hour-long PowerPoint presentation to explain to the assembled faculty that the amount of money he'd committed to building tennis courts at the Student Village was precisely the sum we wouldn't be getting in merit raises that year. Whereupon, I summarily instituted a tennis prerequisite for all my courses. Hub capacity life skills. We've come a long way since then, but not far enough. My own recent experience on the university task force, on the diversity task force, disinclines me to cynicism. The university recognized the problem as pressing. The decanal charge was correct. Our deliberations were open, careful, extensive, and honest. Our 19-person committee, composed of 18 tenure-track faculty and one lecturer, and chaired by a faculty dean, took pains to interview every department and program in CAS for their opinions on the matter. We were provided with all the data we asked for, and we wrote a long and detailed report, which it's my impression the university is taking quite seriously. Two of these interviews struck me particularly. At one, with the writing program, disappointment was expressed with there being only one lecturer on our 19-person task force. It was also suggested that since many writing seminars deal with issues of identity and are taught to freshmen newly encountering college life, and since this has given the program's faculty relatively direct access to student worries about diversity issues and has moved them to design pedagogical techniques for getting students to talk about sensitive issues like this, it seemed rather a waste that no system of sharing had been developed for making this reservoir of practical experience useful to the university at large. Naturally, this raised the question of who might be expected to take the initiative and do the work in developing such a system of sharing. The CTL, Center for Teaching and Learning, offered to use their website to post ideas on how to deal with diversity in the classroom and offered to help organize workshops on the subject. I don't know what has come of that. I should ask. At a second meeting, a department whose name I won't mention expressed dismay that the central administration had killed a long-standing outreach program that they, the department, thought had been quite successful in attracting underrepresented minorities. This had happened, apparently, without discussion, warning, or even notification. Shortly thereafter, I talked to a dean who said that the program had in fact not been successful in that regard. Now, if it were simply a matter of facts, or even of different metrics of success, why would those facts not have been shared, metrics compared, reasons given, consensus reached? I myself don't know the facts of the matter, but for my purposes, they're not the point. As with the writing program, what stung was the fact or the feeling of not having been asked. But to judge from reactions to the hub, it seems this feeling of not having been asked can arise even when one has, in a sense, been asked. So perhaps the problem is partly in how asking happens, and partly in where the power to act on the answers seems actually to be. With regard to the hub, the first question asked of the faculty was not whether, but how such a thing should be implemented. That decision, apparently, had already been taken at higher levels and justified by an impending accreditation deadline. In other words, the hub didn't arise from any need perceived by the faculty at large. That's disconnection at a second remove from not being asked to give an opinion on the idea. On the other hand, this should remind us that even the higher-ups have their higher-ups. State and federal government, accreditation agencies, the U.S. News and World Report, rising tuition costs, trustees, the economy, public opinion, and so on. The problem may thus not primarily be a matter of some essential divide between administration and faculty, but of the real differences in power, perspective, interest, and responsibility produced up and down the line, not only by our internal governance structures, but also by pressures applied to them from outside. I would like to suggest that there may be some virtue and value in distributing this power and responsibility more equally throughout the system. The feeling of disempowerment makes people cynical. And I think we all understand that cynicism is corrosive, eroding trust, participation, and meaningful communication. The vexed faculty vote on divisional studies may be taken as a case in point. This happened last year, year before last, seems like an eternity. One effect of the way the hub came about has been to reinforce the faculty's sense that its power within the university governance system is still perhaps mostly advisory at best, that key decisions regarding its own specialty, the curriculum, are not really its to make. This has been exacerbated by aspects of the implementation process, including especially course leaf, whose form is not inquiry but catechism, and whose referees may be partly faculty but not necessarily specialists. An advisory role is an advisory role, but a vote is a vote. And when a vote is all one has, and all one can do with that vote is to say no, then no may be all that is said. Now, I don't think I can solve all our problems of governance. Perhaps if Susan gives me 5 minutes more. But I hope that I've shown how they can make it difficult to talk.
Thank you all for coming to this panel. I want to especially thank my colleagues, Tamsin Flanders and Siri Hamilton, for their support. Thank you to Susan Mizrahi, Nazli Kibria, Jim McCann, Emily Barman, Gina Sapiro, and the many faculty I've encountered in my years of service at Boston University who, even though I'm a staff member, recognize that I am a person who has ideas and opinions, some of them almost halfway decent. Unfortunately, I cannot say that about everyone at this university and in higher education as a whole. I will try to refrain from making jokes throughout my statement, although those of you who know me know that it will be rather difficult. What I will be is frank, open, and honest. Okay, maybe just one joke. Apparently, comedians like Jerry Seinfeld won't come to college campuses because students are offended by free speech. I take offense to anyone who actually cares what Jerry Seinfeld does anyway, when Larry David has proven to be the better comic. The title of this panel is supposed to reflect the corporatization of higher education, which, sure, that's going to happen when you're a massive enterprise with thousands of employees and federal regulations. But what I am concerned about is the lack of acknowledgement, appreciation, retention, and pay for staff at this university and many others, except for those across the river, because those people make bank. All right, that's going to be my last joke. We are not regarded as essential to the operations of this university as faculty and administration are. And by administration, I mean assistant deans and above. We are considered replaceable, while these faculty and senior administrators, who are also faculty, are not. But please tell that to our looming population of graduate students and adjuncts who are eager to take your jobs. We are rarely acknowledged. I'm sure faculty can name who recently won the Metcalf Prize in Teaching, but ask a faculty member who recently won a Perkins Award, and they will look at you with confusion because they don't even know what the award is. And if they don't know what it is, how can they nominate us for it? And it's an award given to staff members who have been at BU for ages and are very good at their jobs. While I understand that these awards have little translation to the outside world, sometimes it just feels good to be recognized for going above and beyond to further the mission of the institution. When we are recognized, and I'm pulling this directly from a dean's letter from 2017, it's for planning events and paying bills and cleaning classrooms. I am not saying that those tasks are unimportant because they are crucial, but we also advise and engage with students, compile your tenure cases, plan your class schedule, run your orientations, balance your budgets, order all of your books from Amazon, and do all of the things that many of you take for granted. When your searches are successful, it speaks to the quality of your candidate and the hard work of your committee, but also to the hard work and organization of department administrators. We spend our lunch breaks attending professional development sessions on how to make our workload and your lives better. We sit with colleagues on benches and in restaurants, constantly talking about work, brainstorming solutions to problems some of you haven't even thought of. Even with all that we do, our voices are barely heard. Free speech doesn't impact us, except for the occasional Jerry Seinfeld joke, because we are rarely listened to. We do not have academic freedom to protect us. We have labor laws and the mercy of supervisors who care about our opinions. We are disrespected and forced to put up with the disrespect. We are overlooked and paid poorly. When we try to advocate for ourselves and our departments, higher administrators, management, if you will, tell us to look for employment elsewhere, in other departments, colleges, and universities. We are left off email chains we should be on and kept on email chains we should not. There is currently a committee here at BU working on a new strategic plan, envisioning our future. This task force is comprised of 19 members representing a range of Boston University faculty constituents. There are only two staff members on this committee, and they are at the executive level. There is no student representation either. How can our future be envisioned with such little representation? And this is not atypical. Committees rarely have staff representation. Policies are often thrown at those of us on the front lines at the last second with little guidance. Free speech has historically led to amplifying those who have been silenced. We need a diversity of ideas at Boston University, otherwise we are just another corporation.
So I want to thank everybody for coming and for everybody who put work into this and putting together what's an excellent panel. We have, I think, a truly, from a positional perspective, very diverse panel, and it's wonderful to also have the provost with us. So I want to make a somewhat contradictory argument, namely that BU is both too corporate and not corporate enough. To do so, I need to disentangle two different understandings of the word corporate. If by corporate we mean capitalist, then BU has become too corporate in the sense that we are willing to subordinate intellectual inquiry to financial interest. Our administration has welcomed companies onto campus, from the food court in the GSU to the adoption of Amazon Prime. It busily monetizes every aspect of college life it can, from intellectual production to parking spots. But this pursuit of money risks sending the wrong message. Courting wealthy donors may undergird new construction, such as the awkwardly named Booth Theater. I couldn't resist. But it also elevates business and business people over education and educators. This celebration of commercial success has a chilling effect on undergraduate learning, for it suggests that education is relevant only to the extent that it helps students get jobs and fundraisers tap wealthy alumni. The university's commercialization of learning has also reinforced the decline of the humanities. In contrast to chemists, engineers, and economists, there's no clear path to employment for humanities majors. But the administration's emphasis on commercial achievement, so clearly inscribed on our buildings, acts to discourage interest in the humanities. Nor does it help that the decline in our intellectual status is emphasized by in-house publications, such as Research Revealed, or BU Today, or intensified by funding allocations, as departmental budgets are increasingly tied to enrollments. It is no wonder the conflict between financial necessity and scholarly inquiry has led to a siege mentality among humanities scholars. To compensate for our loss of status and funding, we are tempted to view ourselves as the defenders of a certain anti-capitalist faith, one we are prone to equate with education itself. Of course, we know that the free market of ideas is merely a metaphor. There's never been a time when that market was truly free or intellectual inquiry was without cost. Cultural production has always relied on political largesse and financial patronage. Moreover, we need a place in the market, an institutional foothold, from which to purvey our ideas. Thanks to President Brown and Provost Morrison, BU is not facing the financial oblivion that overtook Mount Ida and Newbury and now threatens Hampshire College, and will eventually claim legions of insolvent educational institutions. It is up to faculty to provide the principles that will ensure what kind of learning we'll do here. It is the administration's job to find the principle to pay for the future of learning at BU. But if by corporate we mean bureaucratic, then BU is too bureaucratic, in the sense that busy work threatens to overwhelm us. None of us appreciate the increased paperwork of the post-Silber era, whether it is departmental assessments or syllabus submissions, and I could add the Amazon Prime moment that you have to deal with, which I think maybe the administration just simply wasn't aware of, didn't take into account. The amount of time we spend filling out forms is frustrating, the logic behind them often incomprehensible, and the multiplication of administrators who manage the forms and their logic bewildering and expensive. Moreover, the multitude of measures and metrics stifles intellectual innovation and curricular initiative while inviting uniformity of thought. There's a danger that faculty, caught between the necessity of increasing scholarly output and the need to self-govern, will become demotivated, and capable colleagues will withhold their administrative talents. But the introduction of clear procedure has also brought a welcome reduction in the administrative caprice that characterized the Silber era. New regulations have reshaped the way we work for the better, replacing unwritten codes and informal customs with clear rules, ensuring less bias and greater protection to faculty, staff, and students from intimidation and harassment. As in the corporate world, procedures don't merely clarify what is possible or preferable. They also embody social values. And the dissemination of more tolerant and inclusive procedures has reshaped institutional culture at BU. But unlike the corporate world, our procedures don't go far enough. Requiring the BU community to watch videos about sexual harassment was an important signal about the kind of sexual conduct we will tolerate at BU. But the procedure hardly sufficed to address the real problems of intimidation and harassment on campus. As teachers, we know watching videos is hardly the best approach to understanding problems, much less developing appropriate responses to them. As a result, some WAGs speculated that the administration was merely discharging a legal responsibility as inexpensively as it could. This was a chance to spell out policy, set precedent, and shape conduct, a chance not taken. It is time to take that chance and institute bolder procedures. When the nation is immobilized by empirical falsification, interpretive charlatanry, and the uninhibited violation of procedure, the time is ripe for universities to take the lead and become more ethical, more bound by procedure, that is, more corporate.
Thank you. I think there's a lot to discuss, but just one point I want to sort of start off with, which is about, I think, this issue of kind of the local and the global, which is how much of what the perception is of division, particularly between faculty and administration at BU, to what extent is it sort of a legacy, of the Silber era, and to what extent is it just a more, general national problem that this is. To what extent are we talking about BU specific, and to what extent is it a more kind of general issue? Anyone?
Both. I talked with a lot of people while I was preparing this talk, and one person, I forget who it was exactly, suggested that we really could have used a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that we didn't actually have. My feeling coming in, I came in as the transition was happening and sort of developed various models to try to understand what was going on. One was the transition from feudalism to a rights-based democratic society with all its various ambiguities, ambivalences, and rockinesses. The other I felt that I noticed that some of my older colleagues in particular were acting a bit like my two crazy uncles in Brooklyn, whose father, my grandfather, was a bit of a sadist and died 20 years ago, but they still see his face in every doctor, lawyer, and contractor they have to deal with. So I think there's still trauma in the population, and that trauma generates projections that are not necessarily entirely applicable or accurate. That might be the end of what I had to say on that.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll step in. I think since I've been here at BU, I've been in three different departments that have been shaped in various ways by Silber. And I don't think there was ever, as you said, like a committee where we could just talk it out. I don't think the legacy of that has really ever been addressed. I think it's just been pushed under the rug, whether it be with lines, physical building space. I think now is the time, or maybe it has been the time, to actually discuss with humanities and social sciences departments Silber's legacy and how we can reshape that.
Can I just go back to the global and the local, but thinking at the same time of this, the problem of the Silber legacy? One aspect of that was that there was no consultation. Of course, there was no democratic voting on things. There was a lot of whimsy and political preference. And I think, as I tried to say, I think we all welcome the end of that era. Mm-hmm. Having said that, to pick up some of the things that Peter touched upon, I think that consultation is not the same thing as democracy. In the same way that during the first panel, I think it was Emily who mentioned transparency. Okay, there's the transparency where you tell people more or less what you'd like to do or to see, but you don't explain how you're going to get there, and you don't let people see numbers and things like that. So there's, you know, transparency is also not the same thing as honesty or sharing. And I think that there's a way in which BU has its own traditions. Think about, in my department, we're eventually going to have a new chair. How does that actually work? Some institutions vote. Some don't get a say. The department doesn't get a say whatsoever. We have something that is in between. And so the question is whether or not it isn't time to revisit how these power relations function and who they benefit and how they benefit and then what the broader community looks like.
So I would just touch on the issue of the Silber legacy, which certainly has left deep and wide scars. I arrived, after that era was over, and I think one of the things that's so critical, while we have to recognize that that's part of the institutional culture and that there are obviously important remnants of it, the urgency of competing going forward is really very significant. And so to the extent that we think about how we invest our time and our energy in looking forward and making sure that we're engaged and ready to compete in the coming, our strategic planning effort is looking towards 2030 versus looking back, I think is an important question that we should ask, and that the community should have some sense of. But I have the sense that the urgency of the future is so incredibly important.
Can I? Yeah. I think I've obviously not been here very long as a PhD student, but I've also heard about Silber's legacy. And I think part of the problem is, we're talking about all of these traumas and scar tissues that we're dealing with, but ultimately, all of the mechanisms to counteract that have just been palliative. They've just been kind of superficial. The boundary markers are still pretty much the same. And the way in which we talk about improvement is so minor that it's frustrating that you're supposed to be made to feel lucky. In Silber's time, graduate students didn't even have stipends that were stable or fair or equitable among graduate students, and now we do. And we're supposed to feel really lucky, and I do, because I wouldn't be a graduate student here if I didn't have those things. But it's still not enough. And I think that we have to, and I mean, it's a big, quest that I'm arguing for, but I think it's got to be more fundamental in its restructuring than just kind of, a new sort of diverse population or a new system of monetized income that helps us. I think those things are just, like I said, palliative care.
Thank you. So I'd like to open up to questions from the audience. If anyone would like to come to the mic. And I'm having a little technical problem with this, so if there are questions coming in, could someone... I'm sorry, I'm technically challenged here. Yes, can please... Okay.
Testing. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Am I supposed to introduce myself?
Yes.
My name is Paul Creighton. I have what looks like a distinct position that I'm from outside the university. I come from Allston. I work with the university over the past 30, 40 years as a community person. And what strikes me today is how subjective most of the people on the panel are. I worked with John Silber. I knew John Silber. John Silber was a good man. He had his faults like all of us, and I think he recognized that that's part of being a human being, and in the struggle in life, you know, you do what you have to do and what you think is the right thing. So I think he's getting a bad rap down here. All things being considered, I was in college when he came to BU. He saved BU, in my opinion. He put it on the map. The place would be a backwater school if it hadn't been for his efforts. And what strikes me more than anything is that faculty are in academia. It's almost a bubble. And you don't really have a lot of life experience in the give and take of life. Most people who get to a faculty position have spent 10, 15, 20 years living in the academic bubble. And so why you would think that everybody is supposed to listen to you? This fella here said he wanted 5 minutes, then he wanted 5 minutes more. Can you imagine trying to negotiate something with him? You'd be here all day and all night. So you had
your That was a joke.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it was a joke at all. The fact of the matter is you come off often as a bunch of dilettantes who think that you all know better than the people trying to do the job of running an economic engine in the city of Boston that's probably one of the largest employers of people in the city of Boston, that has a record of giving back more than any other institution in the city of Boston, including the famed place across the river and their little brother down the street. BU has given back to the city of Boston because they have a culture of being part of the city of Boston, and that was inculcated by John Silber. It was a little island here in the 60s. The students almost took the whole place over and buried it, and now it's fighting its way back, and they're trying to figure out the role of the humanities in light of the incredible pressure in our society to turn out mathematicians and scientists and all the computer people and all of that.
Thank you, sir. Maybe we can finish.
I'd like to know why you think you know better than the people trying to run the school.
Can I jump in and say we had a saying here that John Silber did a lot of things, but imagine what he could have done if he was nice. So I think that kind of leaves it.
I also think it's unfair to give all the credit to one person for the kind of blossoming of a university when it's full of many different kinds of people. I wasn't here when John Silber was around, so I can't say like very clearly what he did or didn't do. But I also know that it's not only faculty up here, and we are a part of the institution as well. And I think during his time, it was the student body, the administrators, the staff people, and the faculty that also helped to make BU whatever status that people want to claim that it has. So I think giving credit to one person, as you know, we are doing maybe on the negative way here for all of BU's failures, is also a problem, because it's not just one person that made BU problematic. And it's also not one person that made BU really great. So, thank you.
I don't think I was trying to make the argument that he was responsible for everything or failures or so on. I mean, again, coming here as a young, this is my first job out of graduate school, I was trying to figure out what was going on. And I also saw the aspect you referred to, that, you know, that he had made BU into a major university. And I respect that and respected that. But I also noticed what looked to me like some human wreckage that that process drew in its train. And I think, to be fair, one has to look at both the accomplishment and its price.
Can I just put a little bit of a fine point on that? It's not simply human wreckage. The culture of bullying and intimidation, I think, is a really serious problem. And it's something now that I think we can reflect upon and think about in our own current situation, exactly how much of that is appropriate to tolerate.
Yes, please. I'm Gina Sapiro. I'm a professor of political science, and I've had some other jobs around here. These are really interesting points, and I think I want to follow up, especially on Peter and on Katie. I have negotiated with Peter, by the way.
Negotiated?
Yeah, it was. I'm also at the moment working on a history of higher ed in the U.S., and I think there's a little bit of context that's really important for broadening the questions, as many of you wanted to know to do, which is universities have always been corporate and corporations. The very first American institution chose to call itself a corporation because they are bodies of responsibility that have to be sustainable and carry out their missions. And the question I think everybody's asking is, how do we do this? A second point is, I don't actually know of any institution, any of the 4,000 institutions in the history of higher education in this country that were self-sustainable on tuition alone. None. None. So they've always had to be either dependent on a whole range of different combinations, entrepreneurship, connection with people who had resources to give, churches especially, most were churches, or free labor. A very large number of institutions in the 19th century expected their faculty and their students to start the fires in the morning, to build the buildings, to do all of that kind of thing. So once again, if you look at the history of these institutions, the problems are continuous. The question is, in this somewhat different political economy and our different challenges, how do we do this and keep adjusting so that we can preserve what it's all about in the first place, which is education writ large? The last thing I want to mention, you know, has to do with this question of the culture and listening and hierarchy and all of that kind of thing. One of my jobs when I came here was, and it was assigned to me by the president, was to help make a transition in my unit from what was a very authoritarian and very capricious organization, not because of those individuals. I'm not blaming any individual, and certainly not my predecessors as dean. But embedded in the culture was the notion that decisions were made by leaders who made decisions regardless of anything else. And so a lot of what you're talking about bringing in the rule of law after feudalism, that was what I was assigned to do. But trying to make decisions, all of us who are leaders, and every one of us is a decision maker here, and every one of us is a leader in our own part of the university, raises these questions of taking the responsibility you have to make a difference in a multi-layer cake where you are never autonomous, as someone said, never at any level here, taking responsibility. But if you care about a more collective, more small-d democratic way of working, which I always did, the question then is, how do you do that in a way that includes what my former institution we used to talk about as appreciative listening, a term that made me gag then, but I appreciated it later. Appreciative listening, where you really do shut up and listen sometimes and hear people you're not normally supposed to hear. Thank you, Katie. For me, that has always included staff members who in a university were disregarded. And I don't think we always do so well at that. I think we do much better than we used to. Somebody said national or local, we are much better than we were at that. We are not as good at some places. I have been at an institution which is considerably more democratic. We don't include staff as much. We don't include students as much. But I really appreciate this kind of event where people are really stretching to try to figure out, perhaps, how we can make sure that we have that respect and real appreciation of the people who see what we don't see, especially those who report to us.
Thank you. Maybe we'll take two questions and then can we do that?
I sort of had a semi-response to something that's been going on, I guess.
Yeah.
Partly through the talks and partly what Gina just said. It is going to be a sort of a sloppy paraphrase of Rousseau, but I mean, it was Rousseau who suggested that the problem with society is that it makes people do things for the wrong reasons, or rather that do things for mixed reasons. That is, it makes everybody's motivation a mixture of doing things for the right reasons and doing things because you think they'll look good to somebody or because they'll gain you some sort of advantage. And unfortunately, that describes everyone who lives in society at every level of human activity. So I think we're all mixed characters, both as humans and institutional actors. We can't expect to be educators and not look at the corporate, the income aspect. It's just our activity in socially and within the institution has to proceed from mixed motives. None of us is pure or innocent in that regard. And we're also perhaps living in a society and a social system in which it's actually not possible to do the right thing.
Hi, I'm Julie Levy. I'm a PhD student in classical studies. And I promise I actually have a question. I was curious, everybody seems to come to this with sort of, everybody's got their own institutional perspective, but what is the line of communication that you wish was most open that is not now?
I would say staff to deans and provost level. I think we are supposed to talk to our chair, who then talks to the associate dean, who then talks to the dean, who then talks to the provost. So I think if there was more communication and acknowledgement between those two apparently highly disparate levels, that would be to the benefit of us all.
I would say that graduate students have almost no line of communication right now. I think we feel kind of like we're beholden to what is told to us or what the rules are. And I think that it feels as though, graduate students are in a weird place where we're students, we're being trained to take over or to have a faculty position. So it's almost apprentice-like. And I think that it's a really unique position to be both the kind of beneficiary and the person that's supposed to be enacting the role of the university system. That's disregarded as maybe a valuable skill. None of these committees had graduate students on them that were mentioned here. And I think that for me, because we're so not regarded, I think in terms of having the potential to have any sort of decision-making capacity as a part of the university, as employees of the university, I think it's kind of a number situation. Like, here, me individually, like, I can say what I feel, but I think, there are a lot of us here, and together, I think there is possibility for our voices to maybe be listened to or at least kind of be at the table.
Can I just add, thank you for saying that. I think we do take graduate students and staff, when it comes to communicating what it is that we're all about, for granted. I personally would wish that the upper administration not simply, it was wonderful to get the president's report, and I'm very impressed by how large the Capitol campaign, how it turned out. It is extremely impressive. But I don't think I have much of an understanding of the goals beyond a little bit of language. And I think there's a way in which there are so many things going on in the university that having you here today, Provost Morrison, is an incredible thing. I'm not saying that you spending all of your time showing up at events is the way to do this at all. But what I am trying to say is that there's a way in which, as Peter was trying to point out, there's a depersonalization or it's such a big institution. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard, I think, for most faculty who aren't in contact with the provost's office. I'm not talking about the dean's office, the provost's office, to understand why the administration does what it does. And I think that's a huge communication gap as much as it's also a governance gap. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So, yes, please go ahead.
Hi. Valentin Groschel from physics department. By the way, when I saw the description of the panel, I thought, is it some kind of a payback from humanities to STEM faculty? History, literature. And thank you. that's better. Thank you. I also looked up not the corporate university, I looked up fault line, and fault lines divisive issues that may have serious consequences. And, you know, no one mentioned as an issue like that quality of teaching. You know, does it mean that it's not a divisive, everybody is fine with the quality of teaching students, faculty, grad students? We all know now 42 million students have 1.5 billion trillion dollars in debt. How do we know that BU graduates will not have the same fate?
I think they will have the same fate. This is a short answer to that question.
So I'd like to read one question from the Slido, and then we can. So the question is, part of the corporatization of the university has to do with the central role of endowments and investments. What are BU's obligation? What is BU's obligation as investor? Any?
So that goes, I presume that is a question about how the endowment is invested in the nature of that. Yeah. There is a committee that has both faculty and students on it that is engaged with the Board of Trustees and the leadership and has been engaged in conversation about a variety of aspects of how our investment, how our endowment funds are invested, everything from climate change to guns, and those conversations have been, it has been a robust committee of faculty and students who have been engaged in conversation on that. That's a national level debate. Virtually every major research university is having those kinds of conversations. And boards of trustees and committees advocating for particular investment strategies debate these issues, and then depending upon the interests of the particular university, they come down in a variety of different ways on it. Mm-hmm. So that is, I think there have been regular updates on that from the committee that have been in BU today and, mm-hmm. and communications from the president.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Hi, I'm Sasha Goldman. I'm a PhD candidate in the art history department, like Kimber. I want to thank all of you for your comments and your candor and your honesty in sharing your thoughts. And my question kind of has two parts. I really like the opportunity to talk about these fault lines and these divisions between each of our roles. It does strike me, however, that there isn't a master's student on the panel, master's students who are the largest revenue generator as tuition payers for BU, I believe. However, I think that something that came up in what all of you were saying was how much overlap rather and crossover there is rather than fault lines between the roles that we all have to play, right? Faculty all serve as administrators. As graduate students, we often do administrative work and, you know, some of us by choice, some of us were brought into it. Also, we do some teaching. And I think that I guess my question is how all of you would respond to the idea of, or the question about what we can all, or how we can all better learn from each other and tap into the skill set that each different division has, because not all faculty are great administrators, in my opinion, and shouldn't be put into service in that way. Many administrators have skills that faculty do not have and could be better utilized to do things that faculty are doing. Some graduate students could be doing things better than other people are doing as well, including faculty. I have a big problem with tenure, but let's not talk about that. But I wonder what all of you think about how we could all learn from each other in terms of asking people who have the better skills how to do their roles better. Not super eloquent, sorry.
I'm hoping I'm responding to your question somehow, but I mean, what I was thinking while you were asking your question is that organizing any of this takes everybody a lot of time and effort. It's a matter of work, and that was part of, you know, what I was addressing when I, you know, said that talking with this with the writing program, they had some wonderful resources, wonderful ideas. They were wondering why nobody was using them, but somebody has to figure out how to make them usable, and then design a website or organize workshops or whatever it is. And we're already, as Jonathan suggested, we're already a little unhappy with how many types, how many varieties of this kind of supplementary work we're doing. And so my question to that would be, are we putting our energy into the right kinds of ways of organizing discussion? I mean, our committee is the way to do it. Our task force is the way to do it. I mean, the way we're doing it in my department is we talk with each other in the halls. There's a problem of scale there when you scale it up to the entire university. You know, how big is your hall? I mean, just, dropping in and talking to somebody when something occurs to you, or having a cup of coffee is a different mode from meeting, for committees, and different things happen. But there is a problem of scale and time investment. I don't really know how to solve it. All I would suggest is that maybe other models of making information flow would be worth thinking about.
I mean, there is, if I could just step in, there is kind of a paradox in the sense that faculty don't want to do administration. Most faculty don't, and it's kind of a, quote, waste of their time. On the other hand, faculty want to be part of governance. So, that's, I think, the kind of the central dilemma is how to get out of that. You don't want to do things that are not part of your academic and teaching work. But on the other hand, one wants to have faculty input. And so it's really is, I've seen a lot of positions and activities being taken over by administrators when there should have been faculty involvement, but there's really no choice because there are no faculty don't want to, do that kind of work.
Sorry to barge in here, but the incentives are all wrong. Right? I mean, we get paid based on our scholarly output.
Yeah,
and to go back to, I think, the earlier panel at the very end, there was some discussion of commodification in terms of courses. But there's also the commodification of our scholarly output, both inside the university and beyond. That's what we get paid for. That's how we get raises and things like that. We get paid to teach. We do not get paid. And when we do get paid for administrative tasks, that's not the reason we're doing it, because it isn't that attractive. So it's not. I'm not trying to say that there isn't a way in which many people try and shirk administrative responsibilities and at the same time also want a say in policymaking. Mm-hmm. That is extremely common among faculty. And this is what I was talking about before, and if we go back to your question about fault lines, this is the fault line for faculty internally. And I think what happens is it gets mapped onto the institution in bad ways for staff and for graduate students. But the administration, and if I may, I'm taking an enormous amount of liberty, I think that it's hard to see from One Silberway. I think extremely hard to see, exactly because you're responsible for the institution as a whole, as an aggregate, in a way that I am not. So I think that the only way to do this effectively would be to reorganize incentives, whether it's financial ones. People who do a lot of administrative work, and I don't mean this in the sense of an associate dean, but inside of their own department should be rewarded, except merit pay is tiny. I mean, we could go on, right? So I think that there is a way in which the institution itself is producing a logic that legislates against all of the things that you're hoping for.
Yeah, If I could add a little something to this, I mean, the Amazon Prime thing or Concur. I mean, these are examples of essentially prosumer bureaucracy, if I may coin a phrase. I mean, tasks that used to be allocated to staff people whose work have been freed up from some of that work by those tasks being devolved onto everyone at the university. But there's an incremental growth of that kind of work, and everybody's constantly having to do that kind of work, and it's not rewarded except insofar as you get your books.
I'm going to jump in and be honest, shocker. My thoughts on this are kind of contradictory. On one hand, I think some faculty should stay in your lane,
because we've seen faculty who are great administrators and we've seen faculty who are not great administrators. Same with advising. I stand professional advising like to an insane degree. I think the students benefit more from it than an advisor who has 20 minutes and can squeeze you in. Yeah, I guess we can do X, Y, and Z classes, or an advisor who doesn't show up to their sessions, but that's a whole other thing. On the other hand, and I guess this will address to what Peter was saying, I mean, in every other profession, you kind of have to do your own expense reports. It doesn't take very long. Concur was designed to make that process easier, and with the expanding university, staff have more to do. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to do everyone's expense reports, but I am expected to. So, yeah.
Maybe in part this is also a training thing. I mean, academics are not trained on how to be... Go ahead.
Well, that was part of my point, is that I think that academics are not... Faculty and graduate students, I am currently being trained to be a future faculty member, which... You know, I'm not getting trained to be an administrator at all to do, I mean, I actually worked as an administrator at one of those places across the street where I got paid very well and did a lot of Concur. And so I know how to do that, but you shouldn't be expected to know how to do that because that's not the job that you are signing up for. Not, and I think one of what I was really getting at was faculty are here to be educators and we are here to be teaching our students, and that is the underlying mission, I think, of this university, is to be providing people with an education. And so I do think that one of the problems with these fault lines and these crossovers is that people are being constantly pulled away from what their primary vocation was, is.
That's fair. I think that you can see that in a department administration, you have your best people assigned to administrative work because you can count on them to do the administrative work well.
I know that my own Concur reports take at least 6 times what a competent administrator would take, and much more blood, sweat, and tears.
Travel services, yeah. It's training.
I would just step back to the, you know, the high 30,000 foot level. When I think about the responsibilities of our faculty, teaching, research, and service are the three elements of it. And we are a research university, so research scholarship and the creative work is certainly at the core of how faculty at Boston University are expected to perform. And we are with 16,000 undergraduate students and an equal number of graduate students. Our educational mission is at the core. But by the same token, the service component of a faculty member's profile is not zero. It's meant to be a not entirely insignificant part of how faculty contribute to the university. With respect to the commoditization of work, while we have moved to expect people to do their file their own travel reports, who's flown in an airline recently? You're now the person who does the reservation, and you print out or you download to your iPhone your boarding pass. So you're doing the airline's work too, right? So our entire society is moving away from having a person doing these things for them, and they're moving to electronic-based ways of doing business, and we have to keep up with that. We've got to move with the rest of the world, and so I understand that Concur is
technical term.
I thought that would be the big thing.
What she said, and that it's time for me. But most everybody in the working world has to do it that way. Yeah. We look. Someone used the word earlier. We look like dilettantes when we say I can't do my travel report. But to jump back to the responsibilities for faculty, research, teaching, and service, there are three elements to the expectations for faculty commitments.
My one small comment is that I think part of the problem, again, is if we go to the first part of the title, corporate university, it's a fundamental problem and how it's structured. And I think the word incentive was brought up. You know, faculty are not incentivized to do that kind of administrative work, and therefore they feel like this service component is free work. And I think it just calls for a major redistribution of how we understand labor and work within the university system as a whole. And I think, you know, when Peter was sharing stories of going to the writing program and hearing these like really powerful stories and trying to figure out ways about how to get those narratives out there, I think we need to think about not even just the narrative being out there, but the person doing the work of the narrative out there. And I think, you know, part of the problem with a system in which that's being incentivized and people are doing work maybe badly or they're not capable of doing is that, as always in a corporate model, the people at the bottom suffer the most. And the people with the least amount of pay or the least amount of job security end up doing more of the work. And that's just always how it happens. And so I think, to me, I think it's major redistribution that makes the crossovers that already exist actually equitable and fair.
Yeah, to jump in, I will do all your expense reports if you pay me the same rate as a DA who does none of your expense reports.
If I could just clarify on the Concur issue, it's not just it's not just Concur. I was citing Concur as an example of something that's, you know, spread throughout the world in the past couple of decades. I mean, you know, the difference between putting a token in the turnstile and undergoing that painful and embarrassing six-step process to reload your Charlie card on the Green Line, I'm not trained for that either, and it shows.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the irony is that, you know, along with Concur and stuff that people are legitimately supposed to do themselves, as some of you have mentioned, there's also this expansion of, quote, hidden labor. And we don't have, you know, time to get to one of the questions was about also how it's oftentimes women, staff in the administration, who are involved in this kind of hidden labor, you know, which has this emotional component. You know, I've seen staff holding faculty's hands, coping with their rejections, doing all kinds of things, which, you know, fall to oftentimes women staff. Yeah. But sorry, yeah, please.
I appreciate that comment. Yeah. I had three crying students in my office this week, so I 100% that's a thing. But my question is actually kind of broader, and it is really directed specifically at Provost Morrison, but I would love to hear from everybody on the panel. And it's a question that I sent the question to Slido, excuse me, because one of the things that really came out of your talk, Provost Morrison, was this idea of BU needing to remain competitive, and you just kind of reiterated this. And I'm curious about what you mean by competitive, and more broadly, what we mean by competitive for what specific future image that we have of Boston University. And I ask that question because we're just kind of joking about like our inability to use the T, which is like real. but we run the risk of like this joke, right, of that allows us to say that we live in a bubble, and I'm sorry to say, but I really resent the idea that faculty or graduate students or people in the administration or on university campuses live in a bubble. Kimber's narrative that started her statement was all about how her intellectual work in the supposed bubble of the institution became a very real practical problem of survival when that class was rescinded and she no longer had an income for the summer. So I'm very curious about what the future of Boston University looks like, because this is something that we talk a lot about all the time, but it's this kind of vague thing that is like, it's unclear to me, other than walking up and down Comm Ave when I see posters with students writing in lights, empathy, compassion, right? And I often don't feel those things on campus now, particularly as a graduate worker who only has a 9-month stipend and who is currently working to pay off an awful lot of credit card debt assumed over the summer. So these are very real practical questions about what it is the future of Boston University looks like. And if we are aiming for an inclusive future, what can we do to foster that conversation on all levels?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So I think as we've touched on a couple of times, what defines the university and how we collectively think about who we are and what we want to achieve is in many ways the university strategic plan. So when President Brown came, the first strategic plan was launched in 2007. And many elements of that plan the university has delivered on in the intervening years. And so we're now undergoing the effort. We're now in year two of the collaborative effort to define the strategic priorities for the university going forward. So where we are with that effort, the academic leadership, meaning all the deans of all the schools and colleges, we spent a year doing self-assessments of the strengths and weaknesses of each of the schools and colleges. We put together a white paper that would help drive subsequent conversations. Last fall, we began a series of listening sessions around the university. We held 49 different events, and over 1,000 people came and provided input to members of the Strategic Planning Committee. So we're now pulling all of that together and working to develop the framework for who we want to be going forward and how we want to compete. And what we want to define us as we move toward 2030. And the critical elements that are going to arise from that are academic excellence, excellence in research scholarship and creative work, diversity, equity, and inclusion, community. One of the things that came through really loud and clear from the listening sessions was that people are, and this was staff and faculty and students, are looking for ways to find community within the bigger landscape of BU. And then the final element of how we're, the elements of the plan are starting to emerge is that we also want to make sure that our global character continues to be a critical part of who we are, where we are welcoming students from around the globe to BU, and that our students are having the opportunity to travel around the globe and be knowledgeable about the rest of the world. So the answer to that high-level question is that the strategic plan defines those things, and we're sort of in the throes of it right now, and over the course of this semester, we will be sort of rolling out how we're building the plan.
Okay, so we have about 10 minutes more, and if you could just try to ask questions, keep them to questions.
So I'm a first-year undergraduate student, so this all has been very heartening and optimistic.
this place is great.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful.
No, I promise it is.
So I work at Telefund, which means I cold call people and ask them for money. And I learned very quickly about Silber, and as one of the panelists said, the awkwardly named booth theater. Because one of the options we have when people reject us is that they dislike Silber. I mean, so it came in really quickly. And ostensibly what I do is ask for money and fundraise. Telefund is like a fundraising initiative. But really what I do is I manipulate algorithms. I call people and ask them to donate so that U.S. News and World Report sees an increase in alumni donations, sees an increase in individual donations, sees an increase in amount. And that's really all we do. Myself and many of my colleagues are probably losing money for the university if you just look at what we're paid and what we bring in. So it strikes me as all like, and I enjoy what I do, but it strikes me as very superficial. Like I'm working the rankings. That's what I'm doing. And you start to realize the rankings don't actually equate to the quality of education we're receiving, because like here I am doing this for the rankings that have no bearing on like if my classes are improving. And I'm curious what the Silber legacy, what the effect of Silber was on the quality of education that BU provided, and B, what the post-Silber legacy, what the effect of the post-Silber legacy is on the quality of education that professors and PhD candidates are able to give.
Yeah. If I could just jump in but take exception to your premise that the university engages in fundraising to raise the rankings. The university engages in fundraising because we need the resources to drive the academic programs and do the things that faculty in the university want to do. We're not able to do all the things we can do without fundraising. Endowed professorships is one of the single most important elements that the Capital Campaign addressed. And those are funds that go to, first of all, the professor receives an important title, which is the highest form of recognition we have for faculty, and funds for their research, scholarship, and creative work. And then it provides the dean with support for salary for that person. So I just would reframe the characterization that the only reason we fundraise for ratings, that's just not accurate.
So someone
could also answer the silver question.
Yeah, let's actually kind of get two more questions and get them one after the other, and then we'll give the panelists a chance to wrap up.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My name is Mariah. I teach in the writing program, and I'm a PhD student in American Studies. And I have a question that I think picks up on something that both Professor Zatlin and Kimber framed in the question that Sasha asked. I guess my question is about how we think about being heard and how we think about being heard as being a form of work. Because I think it takes work to be heard. It's not a one-time thing. It is something that takes it takes time. It is extended, and often the answer to being heard is, "Oh, wonderful! You want this thing? You can do it," which is more work. And I think that often, in particular, the university relies on the fact that, I'll speak as a graduate student because that's my main experience, that we are, we become too busy, or we have a narrative that we're too exhausted to do the work of being heard. And I think the university relies on that. So how do we make that work doable? And how do we compensate it? And how do we recognize it? Because I don't think it falls neatly under the category of service. It's a different thing. And of course, it's lovely to be told, "I hear you. You want this thing. Go do it." But how does that become actually feasible in our lives?
Thank you. Thanks. So, yes, if you could also.
Oh, you'd like my question?
Yeah.
Mine's a little bit different. I noticed on this panel that there are no adjuncts. And they're sort of a shadow labor in a lot of universities, and they're certainly shadow labor at BU. They're paid pitifully. They get no benefits. They have no job security. They are at the whim of when they are needed and if they are even hired. And sometimes they go for years and years without being hired as full-time faculty. I know I'm speaking for several departments in the university and at other universities as well. I've been an adjunct. Recently, there was a Google spreadsheet that went around, that went viral, where adjuncts revealed what their conditions were. I'm just curious, how is BU responding to what's quickly becoming an adjunct crisis in academia? As a graduate student, I am being trained to be a faculty member in theory, but I'm not sure that job's even gonna really exist in the future. How's BU responding to that?
So there's the unionization,
So I'd say two things in response to that. At many institutions, the number of adjunct faculty are increasing because the institution is decreasing the number of tenure and tenure track faculty or professorial faculty. We are not doing that. BU has been continuing to increase the number of tenure and tenure track or professorial faculty in schools and colleges that don't have tenure. So we are not. Part of the destructive narrative around adjuncts is that universities are using them to displace tenured faculty. We're not doing that. We have continued to make investments and grow the size of our tenure and tenure track faculty. The other answer to that is that part-time faculty are now represented by the SEIU, Focal 509, and the conditions of their employment are negotiated with the union, with the union leader. We are currently in the first contract has completed its first cycle, and we're in negotiations with them around the elements of the second contract. So that's they're a union, union represented by union now. So the way we deal with it is we negotiate with the SEIU folks.
I would say that the answer to kind of all of the three questions is unions. I think that fundraising and looking at BU's endowment is a very hard thing to do as a person who makes around $20,000 a year here. It's hard to look at those numbers and feel like they're manifesting in a way that feels like actually valuable on the ground in terms of the merits of education. And then in terms of being heard, I think it's very hard to be heard by yourself, especially given power dynamics at the university. And I think in terms of, again, I think distribution of work and of voices in a way that's not hierarchical is the most fair. And so I think that unions is the most practical way to kind of manifest these things, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it's curious that most of us at this table feel so disempowered. Right? Because as a faculty member, somebody said something about tenure. I'm tenured. I have the luxury of not having to think about the political problem, what it means in terms of hierarchy. So I think power is a big part of the issue here. But I also think that the university should really deeply rethink, and I want to go back to those three areas that Provost Morrison mentioned, the way in which it privileges all three of those against the background of being competitive, whether it's competitive in the rankings, whether it's sustaining the educational mission. You said faculty want to do things, except I'm not consulted in that way, whether it's local or up in that 30,000-foot level. So what I mean by that very simply is that as a faculty member, I'm constantly dealing with mental health problems, right? Some of which I am obligated to report, some of which don't rise to that level, but I don't have the training. I don't have the training to deal with mentoring when it moves beyond simply, say, a graduate student or an undergraduate thinking about their career. Mm-hmm. And there's an enormous amount of mentoring, and that goes back to what you were saying about advising. What happens in advising, at least in my department, is very silly. See the student once a semester for 20 minutes, maybe for longer, but that's it. And if I'm lucky, I get them in my class. That's not really, I don't need training for that. That's a question of hub courses and things like that. Mentoring is something completely different. We don't have the time or the funds, and as I said before, the incentives are all messed up, it seems to me, in terms of what it is I'm being asked to do, what I would like to do, and what I can actually do locally to help people. I think that there's a misalignment in the institution. I think it's part of the logic of the institution to do this, and I think the gap between a faculty member like me and people who have to take into account the entirety of the university is too large. I mean, we could talk about focus grouping instead of simply task forces. But when you simply say that there is the strategic plan, I actually know something about how that first strategic plan was put together. And the whole point is that it was put together by people that didn't have a lot of trust of other professors. It wasn't brought back to the professors in a way that it was tested, with not only the language, but the intent behind it, because it's a document that's hard to understand. So I think that there are a lot of misalignments on an organizational level that produce bad incentives and bad logic. And that's the kind of thing that can actually be reformed within this institutional setting. It is a national problem, but it's a specifically BU one too.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're out of time, so I'd like to, first thank the audience for being here. I don't know about you, but I've learned a lot the past hour and a half, and particularly thanks to the panelists who've given us a lot to think about. So I believe it's lunchtime, and then we will move on to the next panel. Actually, picks up on a lot of things we are talking about here, because it focuses on labor
divide. So
when will we reconvene? I think we're a little behind schedule now, or no?
Yeah. What? 1:45.
Yeah. Okay.